Here now is the moderator of today's program, Steve McCormick.
Since the explosion of the first atomic bomb 12 years ago, the nations of the world have been engaged in a frantic race to develop superweapons. The fate of mankind hinges on the control of these instruments of destruction. But in the absence of effective controls, testing continues at a rapid pace. Here in Los Angeles, California, a blinding blue flash at dawn yesterday from the atomic test site in nearby Nevada again emphasized to people here and throughout the world the worries of possible dangers in radioactive fallout. Today on the American Forum, we present two eminent authorities to discuss this important issue. Congressman Chet Holifield, member of the Joint Congressional Committee on Atomic Energy and chairman of the Subcommittee on Radiation, and Dr. Kenneth Pitzer, noted nuclear scientist from the University of California and former director of research of the Atomic Energy Commission. Well, gentlemen, let's begin with this thought. Has our Atomic Energy Commission adequately informed the public on radioactive fallout? Congressman, how do you feel about it?
Well, I've been on the Joint Committee since its inception in 1947. And I say that the Joint Committee has failed to make known to the people of the United States and the world the real true effects of nuclear explosions and the dangers of radioactive fallout.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Pitzer, how do you feel about this? Has the AEC done its job in this respect?
Well, I think the efforts which the AEC, and particularly Commissioner Libby, have made in presenting the facts have been very meritorious. Unfortunately, the cold facts don't get the headlines as well as some scare statements, and therefore, I'm afraid the public has not received the facts as well as it should. But I believe the Commission, and particularly Dr. Libby, has made a very great effort to get the factual information available for the science and the general public.
Do you mean by cold facts that the dangers that we hear so much about and read about so much, see about on the air, on television, and hear about it in radio, these are not existent, that we shouldn't know about these things?
Oh, no, quite the contrary. I think it's very desirable that the public be informed of the various dangers and complications of high-energy radiation, which is a new and important complication of modern life. My point is simply that certain individuals have chosen to exaggerate these dangers and have created uncertainties and worries in the public that are really not justified.
Congressman Holifield?
Well, I have a high regard for Dr. Libby, one of the AEC commissioners. And Dr. Libby has made speeches in many instances, however, they have been made to scientific groups, to groups of small numbers of people, and they haven't been interpreted in layman's language to the people of America. I do not accuse Dr. Libby of any dereliction of duty as far as he sees it. I say that the Atomic Energy Commission has failed to interpret to the people in the people's language these highly complicated and scientific facts, which I think they should know.
Well, how do you do that now? Both of you have worked a great deal with this for the years. How do you explain these things, and why isn't it done? We laymen are wondering about these things.
Well, as proof of my sincerity on my position, for some time I've been trying to get hearings on the subject of radioactive fallout and the danger to human beings. Beginning in June of this year, we did have, May and June, we had hearings on this subject. And we had some 50 of the best-informed people in the United States, scientists who took different viewpoints on this matter, before our committee. And in each instance, we asked them to prepare their scientific discussions and papers and so forth in layman's terms so the people could understand it. And just this last Monday, we released an analysis, which I hold here in my hand, of about 20 pages, which is in layman's language and which explains, I think, in this one little 20-page document, explains more of the real truth and the real facts about radioactive fallout than has been given by the Atomic Energy in an understandable form, the Atomic Energy Commission, in the 10 years of their existence.
Mm-hmm. Is there material in here which would change Dr. Pitzer's point of view, do you feel? Dr. Pitzer, do you think so? Have you read that yet?
Unfortunately, I received a copy of this from Congressman Holifield just as we walked into the studio, so I have not had a chance to comment on it. I did see some of the reports of the hearings themselves, and I'm sure they were very helpful. I think, however, that programs such as this certainly should help public understanding of the subject, I know this is my principal motive for attending this program, is participating, is to help explain these things.
Now, we've read about strontium 90. This seems to be the one that gets all the attention. And you said some of these facts seemingly get distorted in their presentation.
Yes, well, I would like to make a more general statement in a moment,
but
strontium 90 having been raised, let's say a little about it. Strontium 90 behaves in the body very much as radium does. It's in the same chemical family. Those of you that are chemists will remember this. And our knowledge about the effect of strontium 90 is not really as mysterious as one might think, because radium has been known in concentrated form for nearly half a century now. And there have been cases where people received in their bodies too much radium. Fortunately, these were very, very few. And the effects of this radium is pretty well known. A unit, an arbitrarily defined unit, was set up called a sunshine unit, and it was decided that a thousand of these units on the basis of radium experience was a safe dose. The effect from fallout at present on adults is about a tenth of a unit, or less than about one part in 10,000 of the amount, which from our radium experience, it was indicated to be dangerous.
Of course, you
see, we have quite a major factor of safety here.
Of course, we've had the word today that strontium 90 being this worst villain, two Navy scientists warn that strontium 90 may reach fatal proportions by 1970 because of the nuclear test in 55. Have you heard of that?
Yes, I have, Steve. I want to talk a little bit about strontium 90. Strontium 90 is an artificial chemical element that is created in the atomic hydrogen explosions. And the danger of this material is that it has a very long half-life, a half-life of 28 years. It decays at one half in 28 and then one half of what's left in another 28. So it's a long-lived chemical. Now, another property of it is that it is what we call a bone seeker. It's very much like calcium. It goes to the bones. And once having gone to the bones and residing in the bones, it continues to emit radioactive rays, and it forms what is commonly called a deterioration of the bone cells, known as bone cancer. Now, another factor of it is that it can be deposited upon vegetation. It can be eaten by cows, the vegetation. The strontium 90 ends up in the milk, which the child drinks or the adult drinks, and then it goes right into the man's body, and the body absorbs it like it does calcium, and it resides in the bone for a long time. And this is the thing that makes it so very, very dangerous. And when we know that something like 3.5% of the fission yield of a bomb is strontium 90, this very deadly material, why, then that is the thing that causes some of us a great deal of concern.
Does it cause you that much concern, Dr. Pitcher?
It causes me a great deal of concern in terms of the future use of atomic energy generally. And it also would be one of the many horrible features of a nuclear war. If, God forbid, we should have a nuclear war, this would be one of the major after problems. Indeed, I might say that most of the information that we have specifically about strontium 90 was accumulated beginning in the time when I was actually in Washington with the AEC, not from the point of view of hazards of weapon tests, but from the hazards of what would happen if one ever should have a nuclear war. We ought to have the information as to how to combat the problems afterwards.
Well, should we be concerned about these tests? And we hear of radioactive fallout. Now you tell us about strontium 90. Should we, as people who live in this country, worry about these tests?
Well, I want to put this very carefully, the answer to that question, Steve, because this is really a very important question. If the tests continue in the same geometric ratio of increase in the next 10 years, as they have in the last 10 years, and if more nations come into the testing field and start testing, I believe that most responsible scientists will tell you that we will approach a very dangerous situation as a result of the deposit of strontium 90 and other radioactive fissionable material in the Earth's atmosphere and on the surface of the Earth's plants and land.
Is that the way you see it, Dr. Pitcher?
Yes, I would agree that if we assume a great expansion in the rate of testing, which involves many other countries in addition to the United States, Britain, and Russia, and if each of those countries test far more weapons than they have in the past, then one easily could get into a dangerous situation. However, I believe you agree, don't you, Congressman, that is not a danger of the present, but it's a danger of the future.
Yes, I want to be very clear on this, because I think that the people of the United States ought to know this and know it from authoritative and responsible sources. And the testimony of our 50 scientific witnesses almost was uniform on this fact, that the amount of material which has been released into the Earth's atmosphere to date has not caused any detectable harm to the people of the world generally. I'm talking about physical harm to their flesh and the organs of the body. There was some very strong testimony from famous geneticists such as Dr. Mueller of Indiana and Dr. Bentley Glass, John Hopkins University, and others, which indicated that all radiation is harmful, and that particularly could it be harmful to the cells of life, genetically speaking, not physically speaking, but somatically speaking, as we say, but genetically speaking, they feel that there's no such thing as a threshold or a permissible amount of radiation, that all radiation causes mutations in the genes and the chromosomes of the cells of life. And I want to also clear this point up, because they have not been able to prove this as yet on human beings.
So this is statisticians pointing this out,
now,
is that right?
What they have done, they have performed experiments in laboratories on fruit flies and on mice and guinea pigs and monkeys, dogs, lower forms of life. And then they have attempted to extrapolate from those experiments, the results of those experiments, to the human being. Now, here's a point that mm-hmm. I want to bring out here,
right,
is that in that extrapolation, all of them agreed that there is an element of error which they cannot quite pin down.
Do you see that, Dr.
Oh, I agree. I was glad that the congressman used the word extrapolate. That's what I use every day.
That's a big fancy word now.
That is the thing which describes this whole situation. We have experiments in this area in terms of our theories and our best understanding of things. We believe that this will happen to human beings over hundreds of years.
Are the people who
but,
insist
we can't really be say we're sure. However, I agree with the arguments. I think they are reasonable. And I think this is a good time to again bring in a little bit of the general point of view. The high energy radiation, that is radiation that penetrates the depths of tissue, have been with us since the Earth began. In fact, probably more intensely in earlier eons than at present. But it's in the last half century that man has learned to do things about it. X-rays were invented about 60 years ago, and likewise, naturally, radioactive things like radium were concentrated. However, it's only with the atomic energy program that we really learned to get large amounts of these radioactivities. And it's now that the general public is really faced with the problems. I think just as when electricity came on the scene, people had to learn what a kilowatt was. I think we have to learn what a rentgen of radiation is at the present time. And I would like to mention, in connection with the genetics, the best estimates on the exposures which people receive in a reproductive generation, which is assumed to be the first 30 years of approximately
a person's
life.
This gets into the tables, I gather, and so on, Doctor.
Well, there are only going to be three numbers. I think that won't be too much for you.
All right, three numbers. Make it...
Go ahead. The exposure that one gets from medical X-rays, this is over the whole body or the genetically sensitive area, is about four rentgen units. The exposure from natural radiation, that is potassium in your body or things in the soil, cosmic rays and so on, is also about four rentgen units on the average. The present exposures from fallout, extrapolated for 30 years, but at the present rate, not at some expanded rate of testing, is a tenth of one rentgen unit, or about one part in 80 compared to the total. Also, the exposure from your luminous dial wristwatch is also about a tenth of a rentgen, or about the same as the fallout.
Let me go to you, Congressman Hollifield, on this subject, which ties in. We've read this week that Russia supposedly has an intercontinental ballistics missile and supposedly can send this long-range missile on countries if it so desires. We've also heard that Senator Jackson claims that all of U.S. intermediate and long-range missiles are behind schedule. We've read that Army Secretary Brucker says that we're in good shape in terms of the missiles. Now, what happens? You're in Congress. What's going on? Do we have these things, or are we moving too slowly, or what is going on?
Well, you can take almost any position in this field because it's hard to prove the position that you take. In the first place, we do not know exactly what the Russians have done. It's reasonable to suppose, and from such intelligence as we do have, that they are ahead of us in missile work. They captured a great many of the German scientists who were instrumental in making the V-1 and the V-2. And they took these scientists behind the Iron Curtain, and they've stayed there. And they've worked on missiles ever since that time. I personally believe that they're a little bit ahead of us on the missile race. Now, on the other hand, we're rapidly coming up. And I do not believe that at this time the Russians have a missile which they can send 5,000 miles with any degree of accuracy. Mm-hmm. I think that they may have a missile that they can send 3,000 miles or something like that, but I'm sure that they have not solved all of the complicated and intricate problems of guidance.
You're very close to this problem, and you're concerned with top secret affairs. I don't want to ask any secrets, of course, but I am concerned as a taxpayer. Are we moving along? Are you happy with the way we're moving along?
I think we should make a little stronger effort. Our committee recommended 2 years ago that we go all out on the missile program because we saw this transition from the man-operated bomber to the guided and unguided ballistic-type missile. And we recommended an all-out project for missiles. A great deal of money has been spent. But I think the fact that next year we're going to spend about three times as much money on missiles as we did last year, and that money has been allocated, by the way, by the Defense Department, indicates that the Defense Department is now beginning to realize that they've got to go all out and do this job if it's going to be done before the Russians beat us to it.
Dr. Fisher?
I think this is a good point to come back to the weapon testing question in a certain angle, because it is this conversion from manned aircraft to guided missiles, which makes it extremely important that we not give up the right to continue tests unless it's a part of a general disarmament program. And a general disarmament program I would certainly welcome most gladly.
At the moment, that seems unlikely.
I'm afraid it does, yes. But the point is this. An H-bomb is not just an H-bomb. It has shape and weight and all the other complicating factors. And what was appropriate to carry in a B-36 or a B-52 isn't the same weapon, same warhead that ought to be carried on the front end of a guided missile. And therefore, although we have the basic facts, when the new design has been made, it needs to be tested. We can't rely for our defense on an untested weapon, and each warhead has to be patterned, adjusted to fit the carrying vehicle, and this means we need to continue tests for this purpose, if for no other.
Well, I would agree in general with that remark. However, and this is one of the reasons why I think that the people of the United States and the people of the world ought to be told in detail the facts of the reasons for testing and the dangers of testing, and they should be told without reservation.
Because, who should do the telling?
Well, I think that that is a direct responsibility of the executive branch of government. I think the president ought to go on the radio and television with a series of lectures to the people, because they would believe, coming from the high authority of the presidency, they would probably believe statements where they would not believe them from less important people. And I think that the people ought to be told the dangers that are inherent in testing, the necessity for testing if we're going to be in an arms race with Russia, and the fact that we cannot stop testing unilaterally, that it must be a general international agreement. And I think there the president should tell the people the difficulties of detecting tests behind the Iron Curtain. This is a very important problem, and this is one of the problems that the disarmament countries are having at this time. And that is that Russia, while saying that we want to stop testing, they're continuing with their tests behind the Ural Mountains, and they will not agree to a scientific formula of detection, which is necessary if we're going to know that they are following through with an agreement to stop testing. And this is very important. And I think the president should tell the people the difficulties of detecting these tests under certain conditions, which the scientists know about, and also that no agreement to stop testing is worth the paper it's written on unless it's backed up by a firm formula for scientific detection behind the borders of every nation in the world.
Of course, there's little likelihood at the moment, wouldn't you say, that we're going to arrive at that?
Well, I think there's nothing more important to mankind than the solution of this problem of not having a nuclear war. If we have a nuclear war, we can just forget about these dangers of testing weapons, because a nuclear war with the use of 2,500 or 3,000 megatons of weapons on any country in the world will destroy civilization and kill hundreds of millions of people.
Is that the way you see it, Doctor? You're a scientist?
That's as I see it. That is, the big danger is the nuclear war, not the testing.
So we have to continue the test to keep freedom?
If, in order to keep freedom and to avoid a nuclear war, if a few tests, one way or the other, will make any difference in that, the risk of the test is utterly infinitesimal. That is, we must, as I see it, maintain our strength. I agree with you completely, Congressman Hollifield, on the necessity of a check disarmament program, if we can get it, and if not, we just should be so strong on behalf of the free world that to discourage and deter any attack.
Now, the Weather Bureau says that some particular areas seem to get more fallout than others. Is that true? What can the average person do about this? Anything at all?
Well, once you're a reasonable distance from the test site, which is, of course, monitored by the people associated with the testing program, then there is no very, very great change in concentration. But there are variations. Anyone who is familiar with thunderstorms and so on knows that it will rain here and not some nearby place.
Of course, he's concerned with what's in the rain these days.
If thunderstorm brings down some radioactivity, it'll come here and not there. But if this is in the Midwest, say, with respect to the Nevada site, the concentration will not be very high in any one point. And over the period of years, this averages out too, and the short-lived radioactivity decomposes, decays quite promptly.
Do you think, Congressman, this fallout should be then controlled by a public health organization rather than, say, the AEC?
No, I think that this is a national and an international problem. I do not think it can be controlled by local health agencies, although they can police in certain fields the disposal of radioactive waste and the handling of certain types of machinery, industrial machinery using radioactive materials. But when you get to the testing, this has to be done on an international basis. And one of the great tragedies of our time is that that many people who are good, sincere people who hate war and desire peace, are being taken in by statements that are being made, which are in the form of propaganda by the Russians, saying that we are the great carriers of the banners of peace. We want to stop testing. They're not sincere. They have not proven their sincerity. We have been negotiating with them for years, ever since the Baruch Commission was formed, to get them to agree upon international inspection so that we can detect what's going on in this field. And while they say with loud words to capture the minds and the hearts of the people that they want to stop testing, they won't do anything along the line of actually putting their money where their mouth is the saying is.
I understand that Mr. Stassen's going to be sent back to London and told to tell him to put up a shut-up this week. Is that right?
Well, I hope so. I'd say this much, that Mr. Stassen has probably the most important task in the world today, and that is a task of trying to reach some kind of an agreement so that we can stop using or preparing to use nuclear energy to destroy mankind, and so we can turn it to peaceful purposes and make it a blessing to mankind.
Dr. Pitzer, do you feel as a scientist that the government is doing all it can to develop countermeasures to radioactive fallout, or should we someday find again too little too late?
Well, I think the problem is receiving very careful attention, and I would like to say something else this angle, and that is that a great deal will be learned that will be a boon to mankind from the effects of radiation on living systems. We've worried about leukemia. Someday, I think we're going to have a cure for leukemia.
Through the atom, perhaps?
Not necessarily through the atom, but through a deeper understanding of the behavior of the biological cells from which the atom will be an important investigation tool. In other words, whether the atom serves as the medicine or not, I have some doubt. But as a means of investigation, of the way we learn how to cure a thing like leukemia, I think the atom will have had a great part in that.
Are we moving toward that
and
now?
We're moving toward it, and we're moving, I think, with encouraging speed. And the government is supporting a great deal of research in this area. I would like to say one other thing. As we go into the atomic power in a big scale all over the world, generating electric power, this will, too will be a great boon to the world. But the radioactive materials, which come ashes, if you wish, from the atomic power plants, must be disposed of safely. And I hope that this is an international problem in many respects. I hope that the United Nations will continue to be active in this field of supervising the disposal of radioactive waste from atomic power and from other purposes.
Well, as you know, we set up in the last few days of the Congress our implementation of the International Atomic Energy Agency, which meets at Vienna on October the 1st. I plan to be one of the delegates to this particular meeting, and we're going to go into many of the peacetime uses and the peacetime dangers also of radioactivity.
Congressman, I noticed that Commissioner Libby, his name came up earlier in the program, has mentioned that we don't realize that we're lacking so much in training in men of science, that Russia's training three times as many engineers. Why doesn't the Congress take the leadership in this? Why don't they do something about that or try to do something?
Well, the Congress has appropriated a great deal of money to the Atomic Energy Commission, and that money is being used in scientific grants. There's literally hundreds of grants to laboratories in the universities and in the way of training the scholars and scientists that is going on now. Of course, there again, you run up against the old need for money, and everybody wants their particular project carried out, you know, and it takes a lot of money.
Dr. Pitzer, you're dean of the College of Chemistry. Are you happy enough with that program, or do you want to step down?
I think that there is great opportunity for additional scientists and additional engineers
in the
future.
Well, who's to do the leadership? That's the point.
And I think some additional leadership from the government in this area would be welcome. On the other hand, education is the business of all of us. And what we need is an appreciation all through the country, business circles, professional circles, and the like.
I must interrupt. I'm sorry, our time is up. Thank you very much, gentlemen. Our guests today have been Congressman Chet Holifield and Dr. Kenneth Pitzer. The nation's first discussion program, the American Forum, is now in its 29th year, founded and produced by Theodore Granick. This is Steve McCormick bidding you goodbye.
Thank you, Steve McCormick, and your guests. Monitor continues in a moment or two.
This is Monitor, the NBC Weekend Radio Service.